I have got here number 18. Bread and boat again and again.
Bread and boat?
Bread and boat.
Bread and boat.
Yep. Nothing to do with bread and
bread
soup.
Boats.
Bread boats. Bread and boats. This is Mark chapter 8, verses 1 through 21. So there's going to be three stories in this section. It begins with another feeding of a large group with just a few loaves of bread and fish. What ties all the stories together in this section is the mention of bread or yeast in each one. And once more, Jesus and his disciples are shown traveling about by boat. They're crisscrossing the sea. The first story of the feeding is fairly straightforward. The second story regarding the sign that the Pharisees demand is a bit more obscure. And the third story that begins with Jesus warning about the yeast of the Pharisees and Herod is perhaps the most puzzling. The cycle of the third major section of the Mark and Gospel is approaching its close. The cycle opened with questions from Herod about the identity of Jesus, the feeding of the 5,000, a boat trip, and some miracles. The cycle will close with miracles, a feeding of the 4,000, questions from the Pharisees about the identity of Jesus, and a boat trip. The center of this cycle contains stories and sayings from Jesus destroying the traditions which the scribes and Pharisees held on to, and of dismantling boundaries that closely guarded ideas and people from defilement.
Mm-hmm. All breaking.
So,
did Jewish people, they didn't have to pay like Greeks and Romans did if they had to go ask for penance from God, did they? Is there anything like that? So, if a Jew came to the temple and felt that he'd been defiled in some way, shape, or form, did he have to pay also?
They had to bring a sacrifice.
A sacrifice. And
so all of the Christian religions only ask the metaphorical sacrifice or rebirth of a baptismal.
Yeah.
But every religion that was steeped in superstition prior to the Christian religion that we follow now today required that you pay some sort of payment to God before you could speak to him or before you could have any counsel from him.
Huh.
The Greeks, the Romans,
Greeks, Romans,
Babylonians, Persians.
Yeah,
well, I don't know about the Persians.
The ancient Near Eastern, the Indian, Far Eastern.
Lots of ritual.
Africa. You know, they all require, they all prescribe rituals of some kind as a means of communicating with.
It's also
the
as a means of,
world.
Like, of holding on to a superstitious attitude, like, we're not going to be able to, like, instead of being confident and understanding with the relationship of God that he's given you strength and capability and will to conduct your life, you're left with the, well, did I give him enough? Did I do it right?
Did I do enough
do we
to
have,
be...
Do we have an understanding? Is everything okay right now? The only reason why I ask this is because...
You're like a bribe.
Well, like a bribe, or more or less kind of like a way of... It dampens your ability to be confident that you have a relationship with God at that time because you have to do it a certain way or you have to have a certain amount to do. The reason why I say that is because I was watching like a program where these people were living in ancient society and they were constantly saying, well, we've given our sacrifice, we've paid our penance, we've done what we can with the priest, you know, or we've angered the gods, we need to do this, and so...
Yeah, so the anthropological explanation is that religions are, and especially religious rituals, are codifications of ethics at a given point in time. People as they become organized into groups and societies, they want to preserve a sense of order and what they believe are ethical. Mm-hmm. And the easiest way to do that is to ascribe it to some kind of higher power. Mm-hmm. And that is how, you know, anthropologists describe that, that's how religion develops.
It's kind of like telling your kids there's a boogeyman in your bedroom so they stay out of there.
Kind of.
It's pretty close. Pretty close to that.
And, you know, there's probably a lot of truth to that. As theists, we do believe that there is a God. Mm-hmm. And so the reality probably is a combination of both. That, you know, there is some truth that, you know, God has revealed himself, that people do believe in God, but they also want to preserve their understanding of what is right at that particular fixed point in history. Uh-huh. And so they develop religions and rituals around all of that. You know, it gets passed on, and, you know, 100 years later, 1,000 years later, people are still observing it, whether it is appropriate or not for that time.
Uh-huh. You describe your culture and attribute this description and set of rules to a god. So later cultures who worship the same god feel that they need to replicate the culture.
Yeah.
Within their own culture. And sometimes it works and sometimes not.
And what Jesus never says the traditions themselves are necessarily bad. It's how they're applied that becomes bad. Mm-hmm. Paul never abandoned Judaism. Mm-hmm. When he went to Jerusalem, he offered sacrifices, even when he realized that, you know, they didn't hold any meaning. But it was part of who he was as a Jew. It was a cultural thing for him now, not a religious thing.
It was also about not completely offending the,
yeah. And that too.
The community, yeah, in which he was going into also.
You need to participate in the culture you're in. Uh-huh.
So he never denounced the actual observances of these things, but he didn't say Gentiles had to observe them as well.
Right.
In fact, he said Gentiles should not observe
Jewish
traditions, because that is not where spirituality, genuine communication and spirituality in relationship with God exists.
Right.
If you bring the traditions into another culture, you risk attributing the traditions. You risk trying to use the traditions to define God.
So that's part of a little bit why when we learned about the Greek woman besting Christ at that time was because she actually made it apparent that that's the point that he's making, is that we're not changing the world into Jewish religion, we're actually changing the thought process, mm-hmm, of the Christian. We're giving people a Christian thought process that encompasses, yeah, all.
We're creating a new,
yeah,
worldview.
So a person does not have to leave their culture,
right,
in order to worship and to honor God.
And that's kind of what was being said there, was that even though, yeah. Well, anyway, sorry to interrupt you.
Cool.
So, feeding of the 4,000, verses, chapter 8, verses 1 through 10. In those days, when again a great crowd had gathered and they had nothing to eat, Jesus called his disciples to him and said to them, I have compassion on the crowd because they have been with me now 3 days, and have nothing to eat. And if I send them away to their homes, they will faint on the way, and some of them have come from far away. And his disciples answered him, how can one feed these people with bread here in this desolate place? Then he asked them, how many loaves do you have? They said, 7. And he directed the crowd to sit down on the ground, and he took the 7 loaves, and having given thanks, he broke them and gave them to his disciples to set before the people, and they set them before the crowd. And they had a few small fish, and having blessed them, the fish, he said that these also should be set before them. And they ate and were satisfied, and they took up the broken pieces left over, 7 baskets full, and there were about 4,000 people, and he sent them away. And immediately he got into the boat with his disciples and went to the district of Dalmanutha. So this feeding of the 4,000, what are some similarities and what are some differences between this account and the earlier feeding of the 5,000? The 5,000 is found in Mark chapter 6, verses 30 through 45.
The people had already been there 3 days. Had they been going hungry for 3 days? Or had the people brought food and they were running out?
I would think the latter, that they were running out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they, it says that some have come from a long ways, so they probably would have brought provisions with them. Maybe they didn't expect to stay for so long, but they were so entranced and, you know, attracted by what Jesus was doing and saying.
So at this point, a large percentage of the people were beginning to run out of food. As opposed to, you have an impromptu crowd gathered together, and there's nothing to eat.
Right.
Mm-hmm. The disciples didn't argue with him.
In the feeding of the
5,000, at least in Mark's account, it was the disciples who approached Jesus and asked Jesus to send the crowd away. Here, it is Jesus who initiates. He has compassion and suggests that, well, why don't you feed them?
They still question.
They do question.
How can we do that?
I guess that's what I meant by they didn't argue with them.
You've seen it before.
Right.
You think they'd say, are you going to do that again?
So the number is a little different. They have 7 loaves and some fish.
Mm-hmm. As opposed to 5 loaves and 2 fish.
So they're actually doing this in different places all the time, or are these different writers writing different accounts of the same instance?
So
they're both in Mark.
There are.
You read one out of John, or not?
No, feeding of the 5,000 is found in all 4 Gospels.
Right.
Feeding of the 4,000 is only found in Mark.
So Mark writes about
two different... So this is a separate event than on this
one. Two different events.
So some scholars think that there was only actually one, and Mark is telling the story twice.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Why would he do that?
That's a good question.
I think we're getting to it.
And so most scholars believe that there were actually 2 separate events, and they were in 2 different locations.
Okay.
One was on the Jewish side of the Sea of Galilee. The other was on the Gentile side, or where it was more predominantly Gentile.
Okay.
So would that be why the disciples are questioning?
Well, because we read two different accounts the last time we read the 5,000.
Different accounts from different locations.
Different writers.
But this is a separate account from the same writer.
So, and another difference is that how many baskets were collected?
7.
7 here.
It was 4 in the other one.
It was 12.
12.
12. Okay.
Let's see, what else? Let's see here. So, here, there are some other detail differences that may be significant. from one commentary here reads, "The second observation concerns the details of the feeding account in comparison with the first feeding story. Here there is no allusion to the Old Testament hope for a shepherd for Israel like Moses or David, as there is in chapter 6, verses 34 and 40. Also, though, 6, verse 34 emphasizes that Jesus' compassion leads him to teach the crowds, and 8, verse 2, his concern for the crowd has to do with their hunger exclusively. That is, this account is much more concerned with Jesus providing a miraculous supply for the people. We note again in 6, verse 32 and 35, the description of the area as a remote or uninhabited place, which is similar to what is called a desolate place in 8, verse 4. This is surely an allusion to the Old Testament passages that speak of God's future salvation as a new miracle in the desert, like the miraculous preservation of Israel in the desert under Moses, and that describe God's promised time of a new blessing as involving a miraculous abundance in desert places." So, leading up to, or in the feeding of the 5,000, there is a strong imagery of Jesus as shepherd. This is absent from Feeding of the 4,000.
Feeding of the 4,000 is also pretty short cut and dry.
It is.
When you ask about similarities, you're kind of like looking, trying to find something, because when you just hear it read, it's really short.
In Feeding of the 5,000, Mark describes how Jesus commanded his disciples to organize all the people into different groups. It's absent here. Probably didn't need to be repeated. Mm-hmm. It's already been told once before. Mm-hmm. So just mentioning that Jesus told them to sit down on the ground is enough. Mm-hmm. But the difference about the Old Testament allusion is perhaps has to do with the audience. In a predominantly Jewish audience, that would have had strong connections to the promises made to David about a future king, about a future Messiah. Here in predominantly Gentile territory, Old Testament allusions would make no sense to the people, so it's omitted.
Right. So none of it, it's... A lot of the bipolar feeling of the Bible is that they really are using, they're really stepping, they're in two different worlds all the time, so they're constantly having to write to one demographic and another all the time. They're constantly writing to two different people. So each time you're reading something, you're reading it and not, people aren't necessarily taking it in the regard that to get their, convey their points, or having to add things that make it so that each side can understand. And for people that aren't Jewish, never lived in a Jewish environment, basically are Gentiles at this time in this day and age.
Then you need to add extra information.
Are trying to understand all this other side of things and getting more information than they need, because obviously the miracle enough for a Gentile community of this day and age would still be that God came, had a gathering of people, realized that they would need sustenance before they were to leave, and decided to provide that before he let them go.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think it raises an interesting point about how should believers try to communicate the gospel to the world today. 50 years ago, 100 years ago, limiting it to the Americas, North America, everyone had a background, a Christian background, pretty much, predominantly.
Almost everyone.
Today,
There's no assumption there.
You can't make that assumption that even people who are supposedly Christian and attend church don't know their Bibles.
Right.
So you can't start 50 years ago you could start with the Bible.
Right.
You could start with the assumption of the knowledge of the Bible.
No, that was a common ground. Now that is no longer the common ground. But
right.
Christian evangelism still usually starts with the Bible as the common ground.
As the assumed authority. People assume that everyone accepts that as the authority that they live by, because it used to be that that was assumed.
But I think even 50 years ago, people were not taking this and what we've and the steps we've been taking to learn these.
Oh, totally.
Books. I don't think people have been even taking that opportunity to learn it with the genres and with the understandings of who they're actually talking to, because whether you do or don't know the Bible, this is going to be something that's going to make you think one way or make you just think, have to think.
So another difference is that in this feeding of the 4,000, Jesus gives thanks over both bread and the fish. Feeding of the 5,000, the blessing was just, giving thanks was just over the bread.
Really?
Yeah.
Why?
Jewish tradition was you give thanks for the bread.
For the bread.
Okay. In Gentile tradition, in Greek tradition, there's no real tradition.
Right. So the fruit of the blessing of all of God's.
Yeah, so perhaps Jesus was trying to show and teach the crowd there that God is the source of all your sustenance. You know, for the Jews, it could be assumed that they already believe that.
Yeah.
But teaching the concept of giving thanks for what you have, as opposed to following the already established tradition of blessing the bread.
I think it's for what you receive, though, not what you have.
Yeah.
So this is kind of not really just a story for just these people. This is also a way to understand in the future how to talk about the gospel then. Because in what you were just saying is that now in our day and age, we've completely changed from being Gentiles. Now Gentiles are kind of the assumed Jews in a way. They know what they kind of have different thought processes. They kind of know what they want to think, and they can start in different places and have to actually address them in different ways than you would any. Now when you're talking to somebody that may or may not understand the gospel, you have to completely change.
Yeah, you have to. The starting point is you have to start a lot farther back. If a person already 100 years ago, evangelism was actually more of stealing sheep from one denomination to another.
Yeah.
You could assume that they had basic understanding of the Bible and Christianity. So it was a matter of pointing out the differences in doctrine.
Which is why Adventism makes such an evil out of Catholicism.
But wouldn't that, so why would any church ever, why would any church leader ever care?
Care about?
Which church?
Evangelism, why, if that's their only point, is to actually just adhere you to a doctrine of their standard, why would...
Because in more conservative, more fundamentalist groups, those groups believe that unless you believe that way, you are lost.
Your eternal destiny is based on what you believe about God.
It's not just Adventism. It can be.
Oh, I know. It's
a
lot more than that.
Some of the more conservative Baptist denominations.
It's almost every last one of them.
It can be the fundamentalists of Presbyterians. It doesn't matter. Fundamentalist groups believe
that
we are right, We are the only ones that are right.
And if you don't believe
the way
we
are, the only ones who are saved.
She waits. You hearing things?
No, it must be. I swear I heard her going.
No, I completely understand that, and that's what I'm getting at.
And so 200 years ago, 150 years ago, that was a big conflict with evangelists and missionaries. Evangelists thought that, you know, by simply declaring what is right, people would obviously see the truth. Missionaries went and discovered, you know, we actually have to live like the local people. We have to get to know them. But that went against denominational policy for many churches, many denominations.
Right. Hence the whole reason why everybody was heathens throughout the entire 15th, 16th, and 17th centuries, while the world was being explored by Europeans. It just, nobody could have their own culture because that culture was so blasphemous toward God. So my question to that line of thinking is that why in the world of all the power of God would that be left to be the way that it is if it's so, if it's completely wrong? Is that why they had the right in their mind to destroy those cultures and kill those people?
Change is when you believe you're right, everything else is wrong.
Change is hugely threatening.
And change is, can be almost impossible.
Well, that's why when you watch documentaries that you aren't sure about, you're sitting there trying to keep an open mind and going, gosh, man, I don't know. I don't really want to be rude, but geez, you guys sound horrible.
These are crazy!
Because that's what I see as a human. My relationships with other humans are basically the only times they're stressed is when I have to make a decision whether or not I want to keep my opinion or just relinquish it and let somebody else have their opinion. Those are the only times I have conflicts with people. And especially if they're just something idle.
Yeah, what's the big deal?
Can you imagine something that's supposedly that big of a deal?
Well, to an evangelistic mindset, what you believe about God is that big of a deal.
That's what I mean.
I mean, just the other day, just last week, we were at the Baptist church, and the pastor was talking about, okay, so I'm annoying, and I'll tell people about God over and over again, and they're annoyed, and they don't want to hear it, but I've told them I've fulfilled the command from God like I have to do, and that is what is right, and so I am happy. And go, oh, no, no. I'll annoy him again tomorrow. I will. I don't remember how he worded it, but it was very much, yes, I'm annoying, and it's right. I am right to be annoying. And even if they've told me over and over again that they don't want to hear it, it is right of me to keep annoying them. And it just, that's the way Christianity thinks. We are right and they are wrong, and if they keep being wrong, then they are going to die.
Well, and
or they are going to burn forever. And so we have to make them right.
Eternal torment, eternal conscious torment in hell, that particular teaching has a lot to do with motivations.
Right. They are going to burn eternally,
consciously. Motivating.
And so annoying them.
Yeah, for believers who believe in that sort of that particular teaching, it can be very motivating.
Mm-hmm.
But for those who don't believe, for non-Christians who don't believe in that, it is very off-putting.
Mm-hmm.
Because they ask, you know, I as a imperfect person am not going to do that to anyone.
Yeah.
So if I, as bad as I am, so this perfectly righteous God is going to do that? I mean, how? You
right.
can't.
Doesn't make sense. It's not consistent.
I have to save you from. I have to get you to love God to save you from what God is going to do to you if you don't. And it just
that
doesn't
would be
make
for
sense.
All the wrong reasons.
Yeah. It just, to somebody who doesn't already believe it, it's just, well, it's offensive.
Mm-hmm.
It's hugely offensive. And rightly so.
Mm-hmm.
So, let's see. Another thing that's going on here that we may, in our reading, may often miss is that when Jesus directs the crowd to sit down, this crowd is not all Gentile. It's not pure No, completely Gentile.
Mm-hmm.
It's a combination of Gentile and Jews. Jesus is asking them to sit together,
right.
Which is a very, very boundary-breaking concept.
Uh-huh.
Because Jews and Gentiles do not eat together.
Well, even later, with Peter, Paul has to say, hey, Peter, you need to sit with the Gentiles, and that's a big thing for Peter.
So when we look at the two feeding stories together, and as we notice, especially their compare and contrast, similarities and differences, we see how Mark probably does intend his audience to see the mission to the Gentiles.
Mm-hmm.
That Christianity is not just the next step in Judaism, or that it's to maintain Judaism, but it is breaking down those boundaries that Judaism has traditionally set up so that it can include everyone. In regards to Numbers, 5 and 12 verses 7 and 7, some people think there's no significance, others do see a considerable significance. For example, 5 would be the 5 books of the Torah.
Mm-hmm.
12 would be the tribes of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And so 5 and 12 would have meaning to the Jews.
To the Jews.
Mm-hmm.
And so
seven,
that could be why.
And 7 means completeness.
Mm-hmm.
And 7 and 7, so therefore, this feeding of the 4,000 is completing the kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
mm-hmm.
In the first feeding, it was only the Jews. The kingdom isn't complete.
It was introducing the kingdom, maybe. It was starting the kingdom. Hmm. Yeah.
And then, with the feeding, with everyone given enough food, they're sent away. Jesus and the disciples get back in the boat to cross over to the other side.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So they go to the region of Dalmanutha, which no one knows where it is.
I've never even heard of Dalmanutha.
There is some speculation that it is the area of Magdala.
Okay.
So, this story of the feeding of 4,000 illustrates the riddle of the dog, which the Syrophoenician woman answered brilliantly. There is abundant bread to supply both Jews and Gentiles.
Ah, it's an illustration. It's a further illustration of, yes, the Gentiles get bread too.
And there's no lack. Everyone
mm-hmm.
gets fed.
Mm-hmm.
It's not,
mm-hmm.
if I feed the Gentiles, there won't be enough for the Jews. Mm-hmm. Or if I feed the Jews, then there won't be any for the Gentiles. There's enough for all.
So, do modern, when you're talking about now, as a modern individual, learning the Bible, learning about God from the Bible, and you're mm-hmm. hearing these stories from here, you're wondering why God left the rest of the world out of the whole picture.
Well,
because understandably so, there were massive societies all over the world at this point in time.
Mm-hmm.
Why would an all-encompassing God leave so much out? Why would there be no mention of the rest of the world's religions past Judaism and now Christianity? Why would it be so vague? Why would there be so little said as to the fact that there's mountainous nations right across the borders here that believe differently?
The concern of the Hebrew Bible as well as the Christian scripture is not with the rest of the world.
But see, that's the problem with trying to give people this good news, is that if Mark or John or any of these guys had even remotely mentioned to the rest of the world while they were writing that, then there might be a little bit of ease into the rest of the communities of society.
And they may not have known the Hebrews when, as they were writing these scriptures, certainly really had no concept of much beyond that ancient Near East mm-hmm. and the Mediterranean. The Christians may have known a little wider, but it was still pretty much, the boundaries were India, the Northern Africa, and the Europe.
British Isles, yeah.
So in other words, the world as that we know it at this time doesn't include, say, China.
Well, yeah. India.
Where there was really a lot going on at that time.
There was enough going on throughout Persia and the rest of the Eastern world that
there should have been some knowledge of it. There was a lot of knowledge.
I mean, anybody that was that high up to write something like that should have had at least enough knowledge to know that Africa stretched past where it was.
I don't know. I've looked at some of those maps that were written, drawn, and there's kind of a lot of fuzziness in the edges.
But why not at least imply then, with all of the implied
acknowledge
for future
that there's
knowledge,
more,
why wasn't
so,
there some
you know, the
sort
old,
of,
no. Old Testament is about the Hebrew scripture, is the Hebrew scripture.
I understand talking about the
New Testament
writers. They kind of almost excluded the rest of the world just like the Hebrews did, though. I mean, it's written to Christians only. It's not written to Christians saying, hey, the rest of the world is part of this too. Whomever you may run into.
So maybe we would have needed that little side note.
I think it absolutely needed it because it left out the idea that the rest of the heathen. So it instead of saying Jew and Gentile, Jew and Gentile, Jew and Gentile, they should have. There needed to be something Jew and Gentile.
No, Paul talks about barbarians.
He does. He did.
There you go.
Barbarians are everyone else.
Thank God. I mean, thank God he said it somewhere because it needs to be said. Desperately needs to be said.
It doesn't mean uncultured. Barbarians, it has that uncultured idea for us. But back when Paul used it, it meant those who were not Greek or Roman.
Right.
So you have Jews, Greek, Roman, those are the Gentiles. Greek and Romans, they're Gentiles. Mm-hmm. And then you have the rest, barbarians.
Uh-huh.
Because, I mean, a lot of their slaves were coming from Gaul at that time, which is Northern Europe. You know, which is actually was, again, the dumbest part of the world, believe it or not.
Part of it may be that, if the early Christians were told that, you had to go to China. You have to go all the way to South Africa. You know, there's this entire continent called North and South America. Maybe they would have been way too overwhelmed.
Maybe just a little.
Yeah. I understand the overwhelming, but at the same time, I just, I'm a little bit playing the devil's advocate, not much, because it is to me a question that is posed in my own mind when I read these, as little history as I have with it, why? Mm-hmm. As a question that would ring in my brain and is why? Mm-hmm. Why would, if these writers had the understanding to think far enough for Christians of the next generations, why weren't they adding in some effort for the rest of the
most
world?
Most of the New Testament are epistles, and they are dealing primarily with existing churches. So they're not meant to address anything beyond that.
So once again, we're stuck in our society now without apostles.
We're stuck
trying to recreate the Christian church, basically.
We're stuck
as a modern society.
A book that was written to someone else entirely.
The Book of Revelation is technically an epistle. It's written to the seven churches around the Western Turkey.
Because kind of what I'm getting at is that basically they didn't think any further than themselves. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They thought slightly to the future of Christianity for a sense, but they didn't think to include non-Christians after this. Like, they kept saying, maybe Paul glimpsed barbarian, but did they think to gift the world this rather than just the Gentiles are now available?
And that's where I think the writings of the early church fathers, which are not part of the canon of the Bible, come in.
That's something that was in that silly documentary too. But
those show, you know, for example, Thomas is supposedly have gone all the way to India.
Where
did Mark go? Did he go to Africa? Mark might have gone to Africa.
The writers of the Bible, did they think that Jesus was going to come back right away and finish everything? Did they imagine
this long
the world lasting
maybe not
another couple thousand years?
I wouldn't have.
Did they imagine 2,000 years into the future?
And
whoa.
Paul deals with, in some of his later letters, the idea that, the first generation is dying off.
Well, and that was
it. So we need to preserve this so that we can pass this on to the next generation.
My point really doesn't have to deal with the Christians anymore, though. It's the point is that the Christians didn't. It in the teaching at that time, it was only encompassing once again two factions. There was not a lot of writing that's saying. Yeah. Yeah, okay, Jews and Christians can sit together now, but what about Jews, Christians, and heathens sitting together right now? What about, you know, they always say like, oh yeah, well, the dogs in the street are welcome too, but they're not, it would be like us now saying that, aliens can believe in God.
I think that
too
would be too overwhelming. It was like working on one problem at a time kind of thing.
I understand, but there still could have, because now we don't have an inroad to those individuals.
Well, see, that's why we're not supposed to limit the Bible to their literal words.
Yeah.
No, I agree, but what I'm saying is there isn't, we don't have anything to reference, though, in it to those individuals that aren't there. You know, it doesn't, so when you have somebody in a literal, not in a literal, but when you have somebody in a skeptical mindset and you're trying to show them a written form of information to help them ease their...
You do have a point there, because there were no ancient skeptics. They all believed
one way or another
in a god of some kind.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So now we have more gray area.
That's what I'm talking about, is that there isn't any way to...
I never thought about that.
To fold them. To give them the written thing that God said, you know what, guess what? Everybody's involved in this.
Yeah. Traditionally, Romans 1 has been interpreted when Paul writes about the idea that God was known to all, that it was that, and so the creation is a proof of God's existence. Traditionally, most Christians have taught that, have interpreted that to say that, see, there, this is the argument from design. Mm-hmm. Of God's existence from design, but that's not what it is.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Back when Paul was writing, everyone believed in a creator of some kind. It was a matter of which one.
Uh-huh. There, atheists didn't exist.
Christians yet. Were called atheists because they believed in only one God.
Right. Well, see, that's kind of... My point is it's not just like, oh, they didn't include Buddhists or this or that, but they didn't give us a text, a writing, something somewhere that said that God's knowledge of the... It's unfortunate because it gives you no historical account of God knowing of the rest of the world.
Well, so it comes down... See, what you're looking for is... the Bible, or at least part of the Bible, as a code book.
Not necessarily even a code book, but it's always talking about the
Bible
it's
is
giving you a line to God, or a relationship of God, or a depiction of Him. But what it's leaving out is to a modern person
and
that knows the world as it sits now, that sees it in its full encompassing
and
tiny little thoughts that it is.
What I'm hearing it is, you know, what you... you're looking for is somehow that the Bible would contain some sort of God's omniscience of the entire world.
Well, just that it didn't all involve this one tiny little point in the, you know, people couldn't even have running water history, that now we live in this world, and I believe they had running water, by the way, but I'm just saying their society was much greater than we give it credit for, but how...
But that's not acknowledged in the Bible.
How in the world did all of this go on without some acknowledgement by the supreme being of the world knowing that the rest of it existed?
So the Bible is a product of human minds.
Uh-huh. The Bible is written by regular people who did not know about...
or did not consider China important.
But see, okay, again, it's not really about the regular people knowing or not. You can get mad at me all you want, but what I'm getting at is that if these people got their information from God, or supposedly getting it from God, where is the omnipresence of knowledge of the world beyond that point in history? I don't even have to say the rest of the world. That is my biggest problem with reading these things, is trying to sit back, think about it in everybody else's mind, wonder what to do with this person or that person. But what gets me is that they don't... it's never mentioned.
Uh-huh.
It's never mentioned that the entirety of that world may even exist. We've got the world where God lives. We talk about that. We talk about the kingdoms that God is living in at that point in time. And watching all these ancient documentaries and stuff starting to make me realize that, okay, so each one of these people's lands, like they say things like, oh, you can't disrupt this god, and it's wrong to piss this god off in his land, so you got to respect him while you're here, type things. Where was all of that writing? There's none of that talking about that.
You really got to put yourself in the people back then.
Most you're not going to get a modern person to believe you to do that, though. You're gonna butt heads with modern thinking people when you try to pose a belief system and say, well, you just got to go back in time in order to get it. They're going to be like, yeah, well, go ahead then. See you later. I'm going to live up here.
Well, if the starting point is that the Bible communicates to moderns as it as is, then we have a huge problem.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Because it doesn't.
Mm-hmm. There's that one point that I wish was there so that I didn't, in my own mind, sometimes feel like, well, am I
that
somehow...
That was for them, not for me.
Well, not even that. Am I somehow missing something because I'm trying to relate
to
understand something that leaves out a small, somewhat insignificant point, but that the more it's a grain in my brain, the more I ponder it, I wonder where that knowledge went. How come it's not there?
So the barbarians of the Celts of Scotland, the Spanish, the North Africans, they would have been to the Jews as exotic and as far away as the ends of the earth that we know today.
Okay. And they were accepted in that church?
Sure. Yeah, so here it is. The Bible was not written for us.
So that's got to be the lead point then. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. There are... It reveals things about God that we can learn from. But it was not written for us. It was not written to us.
That makes so much sense.
We can learn from an ancient people's perception of what God is and how God related to them. But...
And so this is
and
where...
And traditionally... Christianity has tried to take that and apply it whole cloth to their own culture.
Yeah, in more conservative leaning churches and groups, the Bible is considered the complete and fully formed, perfect Word of God. Mm-hmm. And so it is in every way for humans today, for people today. Because God cannot make a mistake.
Yeah.
I'm not going there.
Yeah. Well, I agree. I do wholeheartedly agree, and I'm not trying to discount anything. What my biggest point is that if you're dealing with a modernist thinking society that has the world encompassed thought process and this, you know, we're a very small planet now, unfortunately. There's no mystic left in it. There is, but there isn't. People really think they got it figured out now. So when you're trying to bring spirituality to people, oftentimes history is the worst possible thing to add to spirituality. That's why so many people want to just believe in something that doesn't have anything to do with the Bible because they don't want the history lesson. They want to go off to some Hindu guy and just be told that you'll be reincarnated as long as you're a happy, loving person and love everything too. Because they don't want the history lesson because, unfortunately, history has a really bad habit of being able to be portrayed to the propaganda of the person that's writing the story.
Well, and some of the people who believed in this Bible also have been a really bad example for us to follow. Throughout history, there's been Christians who have been a bad example to follow. Mm-hmm. So you don't want to say, you don't want to...
So
well, you can't appeal to history in some ways, but
the Jews
don't want to say, follow the example of those who went before.
The Jews have never really had a problem with reinterpreting scripture as time goes on. It's the Christians who have had problems with that. that once it's fixed on paper, or whatever it was written on, it cannot
change.
It can't
evolve.
That interpretations cannot change either.
Mm. Well, but that's what I was talking about with the legalistic attitude toward religion is that it can always be changed. It's always situationally varying. Like I say, there's always that joke of the guy walking down the street and running up to the rabbi and saying, "Hey, I want to buy a new sports car, but I don't know how to get my wife to figure it out the way, or to accept it the way I want her to accept it. So, morally, how can I do this?" And he says, "Well, can you afford it?" And he's like, "Of course I can afford it." "Well, why is it immoral?" "Because I'm a grown man and I don't need something like this." "Well, you know, is it for the vitality of your relationship with your wife that you'll be able to drive the sports car and be more excited in life?" And the guy goes, "Yeah." And he goes, "Then you can buy a sports car." You know, and so in a legalistic fashion, all of these things are very mobile. The religion is mobile at all times. If you sacrifice enough here, you can do something over here. If you have these rituals that you abide by this way, then things can be solidified. But unfortunately,
you can manipulate it to make it.
The unfortunate
serve you.
Problem with Christian religion is that there isn't a set definition of guideline, so everybody just decides to make up their own. And the only thing I'm getting at when I asked that question earlier is literally the fact that if you're missioning or evangelizing in the known world that we have today, I'm not talking about some place backwater in the middle of nowhere where you can just like light a lighter or have internet and suddenly everybody wants to listen to you. I'm talking about the individuals that live in our cities here and in our growing third world populations that are, they don't want to listen to God anymore. They don't want a God anymore. They don't want to know that the world actually has a creator. They want to believe that they're an accident. And those people, when you start presenting religion to them, are eventually going to get to the point where I'm starting to and listening to this and start asking, where's that omnipresent mindset? Where's that one little glimmer of the fact that the God that's talking to these people saw the rest of the world when he was talking to them? Because there is some. There's some parts of it, but too many times where they show this glimmer of the world, but then it goes back to Jew and Christian only mindset.
Well, my suggestion may be to take a look at the mythologies of world mythology.
That's where I started.
Because there are similarities.
There's very, very apparent similarities. In fact, that Joseph Campbell guy talks a lot about how when Christ spent his 3 days dead, that there was a time when all religions were touched by God, and that that's where a lot of the similarities and stories of creation start, stories of flood start, stories of basically similar in the religions of the time. But that's not in the Bible, so it's hard to you'd have to
somehow the Bible has been made into this thing that is supposed to be more true and more perfect than all other writings. And what if it isn't?
Yeah.
When Paul spoke to the Athenians, he didn't start with scripture. He started with his
philosophy.
Philosophy and mythology.
Right, right. Okay, well, that's all I was going with that. I'm not in any way, shape, or form trying to discount something. I'm really, literally just trying to say that as a modern person, and I don't plan on doing it, which is unfortunate, but trying to speak with individuals about spirituality, I find myself having to run as far away from that first and entice somebody to believe in God through spirituality first, through some sort of act of kindness, of humanity. of person to person rather than mm-hmm. the last thing I can do is involve history and religion.
Right, right.
With anything that has to do with bringing somebody to God, because the first thing that happens when you bring somebody new to a religion like Christianity through history or doctrine is they, if they need it, if that's that structure that they need in their life, they go to it and it becomes something of a crutch, and then they become those fundamentalist people that you, that you can't talk to anymore because it saved them, and there's no way you're going to change their mind about
it
anymore.
We've seen it happen.
So that's kind of where I'm kind of going with that, because there's got to be some level of, you know.
Yeah, what we've been seeing in Jesus' examples, Paul's examples, is there is no set formula. Each person is different. Each family is going to be different. And whatever works.
Right. Well, so that might be the omnipresent part of it, I guess. But it's certainly what I've seen, because I've seen time and time again where, like, it happens with addicts, too. You have levels of people that have addictions that are in counseling, and some of them will berate a person that isn't coming to their meetings enough because they think, the meetings are what saved me. This is the only way you're not going to fall back into being an addict again. You have to come. And for some people, the structure of that environment is too much for their personality. Maybe they need the camaraderie.
Maybe they need the discipline
sometimes. Maybe they need to know that there's somebody to go to if they feel that way. But they may not need a constant presence of discipline like that in their lives. And so there's some of the things like that I think about a lot of that aren't written.
Some of the things that are written just don't seem right. Just don't seem right for what you would want to say to somebody.
No, mostly like if you want to evangelize or talk about God to people, you really, if you had, like I say, if you had that inroad where it said something about the entirety of the planet rather than just Christians and Jews all the time.
And there might be something like that.
But it's so small.
I don't know.
It's so minute that it's hard, because you have people that are going to say, well, what about the millions of people living all over the world at that time? Were they not saved because they didn't know the word of Jesus? They didn't know who he was or who Christ is. And some people will literally sit back that are fundamental and say, yeah.
Mm-hmm. To some people, that's the case.
And then if you talk to those people, they're going to say, well, that's how it can't be true that this is written by God, because God would have known that. He would have put him in there.
If your eternal destiny is based on whether or not you believe a particular way, Then yes. That's the way it is, and it's not going to work.
Yeah.
In my mind. But I just don't think it is.
No, I don't either. But it's just something that I've been. It's been kind of creeping up every now and then. Like, okay, well, all this is well and good, but where's the rest of it? Where's the people that, not just the people, but where's a little bit of the.
Maybe the value of the rest of the world? The fact that the rest of the world is acknowledged and valued?
That and a lot more. Like, you know, I mean, I just, it's hard. It, Mark says it when he says it right. This is the work of men writing this. This isn't God exactly writing it, so of course it's not going to be.
There's some input from God, but it's all always from the point of view of a fallible person writing. And fallible people who don't see the concept of the rest of the world as being a thing. This is their known world. And if China exists in their mind, it's
there's definitely some in there, though, because if they're making you think about, you know, if Mark is, what Mark wrote is is ridiculously important reading it the way our Mark is presenting it to us, because without the knowledge of the understanding that we need to use the cultures around us to bring spirituality to people, we would be left with nothing but that to take with us and say, well, this is what I got. Mm-hmm. This is how you're going to have to swallow this, and if you can't, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
It kind of relieves me to hear that, because I don't have that ability. I don't read my Bible like I should.
In a lot
of Christianity, I'm not learning it on my own.
What is written in the Bible is everything that there is. There's nothing more.
Right. Well, I don't really have many profound conversations with people like that anyways, because I get in trouble because I don't know enough of the Bible to talk to them anyway. Yeah. So.
What the Bible is about is a story of God working through the Hebrews, right, and the Jews and the early Christians.
I just want to carry her around like that.
It doesn't exclude the possibility and probably the likelihood that God worked through whatever means were available in different cultures.
No, it doesn't exclude it. That's the... Mm-hmm. At least the best part of it is it doesn't say that's not possible.
I mean, did God work through the Incas, for instance? We just don't have a written record of it.
Pastor Bob has told the story a number of times about before the first Christians came to Alaska. Mm-hmm. The natives told the story in Southeast Alaska of a great flood.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And how there was... they tied a canoe or a kayak to, you know, like, a devil's thumb or something.
Yep.
In order to be saved.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Like, where did that story come from?
Well, that's what I was talking about the Joseph Campbell thing that I watched several times when I was a kid, talking about Christ's resurrection having to do with... and walking the world as he was coming back to life again.
Mm-hmm. Mythologies have stories of gods coming to Earth.
Yeah.
At least in there's a Hindu version where this god dies and comes back to life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I quite honestly have never... That's, I think, what our modern problem is that a lot of people want to believe in the supernatural. They want something beyond their size. And the majority of the population is starting to lean towards some extraterrestrial being as far as an actual alien, because the fundamentals of religion have made it impossible for most people to become religious anymore. They don't want the stigmas, they don't want the problems, they don't want the history lessons. They just want to believe in something bigger than themselves. And myth helps serve those purposes. And I think when people can have a myth of something rather than a steeped in protocol and history and especially in such a long time ago, as far as accuracy is the problem. It's always really easy to stay in a land far, far away once upon a time. But to stay in a land not so really far away, but in a really long time ago, but at this specific time with these exact characters during this exact moment, it turns into a lot of people saying a lot of the same thing, but differently, or fighting over points and references really terribly, and sometimes I just want to wash my hands of it and just be like, alright, fine. God exists, and if somebody asks me further than that, it's like, well, I don't know, because I really don't want to have to make up a whole world to to give you what I think, you know, like I just want to believe that there's no way that I could be here by accident, or that this is something that somebody just let that molecules ran into each other and this whole thing just happened or something like that. But at the same time, I really have a hard time trying to keep up with everybody in their scholarship of God.
I like to say that I believe that there's something bigger than me. And I believe God is good. And that God loves me and loves everybody else. And that's kind of about it.
Well, it's hard.
And there's a lot of other things I believe, but it's all based on those things. There is something out there that is bigger than me, that is good.
Yeah, I mean, I really, really do believe the story of Christ, because I believe there has to be a reason why something like that was written and adhered to, and people must have seen that it had to happen. But my biggest problem with it lately is having to be so skilled in the scholarship of it to present it that it's almost impossible to give that story to anybody.
Yeah. Well, and to be able to explain why Jesus is a reality without it being just based on, well, there's this book, and everything in it is true, and everything in it is factual, literal, which used to be the basis of everything.
Yeah.
It used to be that it was all based on the factual, literal interpretation of the Bible, and everyone assumed that that was true, and so you could start there and just say, well, since the Bible says this, then there you go.
Well, I certainly appreciate getting to comb over it like this, because I don't use it to my benefit to talk to somebody else. I just, in my own mind, it helps.
But just understanding
thinking about things,
what it's all about. Whether or not you necessarily explain it to somebody, but just the fact that we can understand what God, that we can better understand that God is there and cares for us without the requirement of all the words being literally factual.
Yeah, I don't think it's necessary to know how to explain the Bible. I think what we need answers to is, what is life-giving to us and what is not life-giving.
Wow!
And be able to explain why for those things. What gives you life?
Well, I know for myself, I don't know for everybody else, but I know for myself, having somebody to look up to certainly gives me an incentive to try and to become a, not a better person, I don't mean morally better, but having the idea of something greater than myself gives me strength and gives me the will to want to do greater things myself. So it's like when you're working with somebody that is physically stronger than you or knows a job better than you and is a really awesome, nice person, then you look at that and you're kind of like, well, you know,
you can,
I could maybe be like that,
you can,
too. So
they can be a mentor.
Yeah. And so the idea of being an accident or there being no purpose to my existence does not create a drive in me to be a more exciting person, I guess.
But maybe seeing God as a mentor is more constructive and more life-giving, like you said,
right,
than seeing God as the source of the rules.
Well, either way, but just having a God in general, really, I mean, at all, gives mm-hmm. people incentive, mm-hmm. whether it's bad or good, how they get it, I don't... That's kind of, my point is just God itself, yeah. But then the morality or the difference between relationship with people is another thing that is tacked on to the personality of God that we want to depict ourselves through. And so when we discount God, when we say there isn't one, when we say there's no need for one, we're basically saying that we don't want a relationship with people and that we don't want to become anything more than human. In a sense. I mean, because if it's all an accident, then really there's no point to trying to make playgrounds and build your own defined world that you have, because... Mm-hmm. So anyways, I just think that it's important to have a God. Mm-hmm. I hope that thing was off and wrap it up for rant.
No, it's still on.
Oh, well.
Jesus is going to be different and not necessarily a short answer for anyone.
Yeah. No, it definitely adds a lot of longevity to your answer.
And I think it's more, it's deeper and more interesting than simply, well, I believe in God and I believe in Jesus because someday I'm going to go to heaven instead of hell.
Right. Right.
That answer doesn't hold much appeal. It doesn't really explain anything.
No, it's like when people first come to the church and they hear, well, just give it to God, and they're standing there going, well, what am I supposed to give, or how am I supposed to give it, or what are you talking about?
What's that mean?
You know.
Yeah.
But I like that, what, you know, how does asking somebody how they know, want to know God wanting to understand why somebody wants to know God is a really good place to start.
Yeah, but if a person doesn't care about God, you know, it's probably not the right time to try to tell them about God.
No. But it's a good question to ask.
It is.
Why you don't?
That's also a good question.
What is your reason that you don't want to?
If they're not interested in God, then they probably have strong opinions about the subject. What do you think about God?
But then, what Mark says about wanting to understand why somebody wants to know God, that would be a good question to ask yourself, so that somebody asks you, you have an answer. Not necessarily an answer for them, but you have one for yourself. It's a good thing to think about, because it's very important to be able to give some report, because it's a question that we need to ask ourselves a lot.
Why do I believe in God? Yeah.
And I think what the New Testament is showing is a response of the apostles to that question.
Well, it certainly helps. With not really needing to understand why God didn't know the rest of the world existed. Because it is, you know, it's a more internal question or a more personalized question. That's another one of those dualities of the Bible where you're constantly wondering, is it for the church or is it for me? When they're talking, am I supposed to think about this for the church?
So anyway, that's kind of it. We got through a third
the section
of the section, and it took us an hour and 20 minutes.